Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
A new report reveals that from 2018 to 2019, there were a total of 156 journalist killings recorded worldwide. It was released to coincide with the United Nations annual International Day to End Impunity for Crimes Against Journalists, which was yesterday, November 2nd. Keep this in mind, this idea of impunity, as you consider the recent ruling about the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. In September, Saudi Arabia issued, quote, final verdicts against eight suspects. Five of the eight defendants had been sentenced to 20 years in prison each, two had been sentenced to 17 years each, and one was issued a 10-year sentence. And according to reports, the process was not transparent. His fiancé and family called the verdicts, quote, a mockery of justice, but not unexpected given the current rulers of the kingdom who are believed to be the ones who called for Khashoggi's death. What was it about the 59-year-old self-exiled U.S. resident that made him a target for those with great power? A new film called Kingdom of Silence gets to the heart of this question by examining Jamal Khashoggi's life and career. The film follows his evolution as a journalist and as a proud Saudi Arabian, and his desire for his home country to do better and to be better ultimately cost him his life. Here is the opening sequence from the film Kingdom of Silence.
Today, the United Nations released a report on the assassination of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And I must warn you, this report is the most horrifying thing that I've ever had to read from this chair. It says,
on Tuesday, Jamal Khashoggi walked into this Saudi consulate
and seemed to vanish.
There is an anxiety that he could have been spirited out of the country.
The Saudi government still offering conflicting narratives.
Jamal worked directly for the royal family in different capacities. He was a loyal Saudi, but how he defined that loyalty over time changed. As did the kingdom itself.
The film also reveals how the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia created a complicit environment where world leaders, if they were deemed important enough, could get away with literally murder. The film was directed by Rick Rowley. Rowley is an Oscar-nominated documentarian. The making of the film took Rick to London, Washington, Istanbul, and to Saudi Arabia, where he worked surreptitiously to make the movie using a tourist visa after being denied press credentials. Kingdom of Silence is available to stream on Showtime and Showtime's YouTube channel. Rick, welcome to All of It.
Thanks so much for having me.
How did his identity as a Saudi shape Jamal's early journalism?
You know, Jamal's life is just completely fascinating to me and really epic. I mean, he's a man who lived his life at the center of this whirlwind. He wasn't just kind of a journalistic observer of history. He was an active participant in it, like at every stage. So his story began, or his journalistic journey began when he was just 26 years old in 1987, when he went to Afghanistan to cover the war there against the Soviets, the Mujahideen War, where the United States and Saudi Arabia were funding and supporting Arab Mujahideen as well as the Afghan Mujahideen's war against the Soviets. And he managed to get access to Osama bin Laden, who was at that time completely unknown. And he took the first photograph that was ever published of bin Laden. And that kind of, you know, reporting scoop made him into a celebrity in Saudi Arabia and around the world. And he, it really is how he kind of cut his teeth. So at that moment, he was living his life at exactly the crossroads between U.S. geopolitical interests, Saudi intelligence and its operations in the greater Middle East, and you know, an evolving kind of world historical moment.
In the film, Jamal's work is described by someone as reporting, explaining, and spinning. So what's an example of his reporting, an example of his explaining, and his spinning?
Yeah, absolutely. So Jamal went through these moments of massive transformation. In the 1980s, when he's covering bin Laden and the Mujahideen War, this is a time when the Mujahideen are heroes, when they're welcomed into Ronald Reagan's White House. He calls them the moral equivalent of the founding fathers. They're backed by the CIA and Saudi intel, and Jamal is the person who introduces them to and introduces Osama bin Laden to the world outside and helps build his story. So then when September 11th happens, it shakes Jamal to his core. And this is a thing that is a thing that is repeated over and over again in Jamal's kind of life. He found himself, he found his heroes who he'd helped create, who he defended in the press. He saw them turn into villains before his eyes, and he realized that he had participated in helping to promote someone who, had committed an atrocity and he was implicated in it. And so, Jamal's story is in many ways a redemption story, because time and again he sees this happen and he's transformed by it. So after September 11th, he turned on bin Laden and was one of the first and loudest Saudi voices to denounce it, denounce bin Laden, denounce the kind of religious extremist movement from which he came at a time that was when it was very unpopular to do that in Saudi Arabia. So he saw this kind of binary choice in Saudi Arabia at the time between Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda's brethren, other kind of Islamic extremist movements, and the royal family, which was the force that was holding the line against it, mm-hmm. in his mind. So he threw his lot in with the royal family and he became their champion. That is a moment when, he moves into spinning. I mean, he's then defending the royal family against critiques and attacks from inside and outside, because he sees it in a way as the only force that can counter this horrific movement that he participated in creating. So I think the lowest moment of that you see in the film, when he is, a supporter of the Iraq War, because the Iraq War is the method by which Saudi Arabia is going to maintain its relationship with the United States and with the Bush White House, even after September 11th, and kind of downplaying the repressive operations of the Saudi princes. So once again, he is living in this kind of world of tortured compromise. And then the Arab Spring happens, and it shakes him again. And when he witnesses the Arab Spring and this moment of rebirth of freedom in the Arab world, it becomes clear that he has to take a stand and take a side. And he turns on the princes who had been his patrons his entire life. And that is what, leads to his death in the end.
My guest is Rick Rowley. The name of the film is Kingdom of Silence. We'll dive into 9/11 and Arab Spring in just a minute. But I do want to bring in this sort of parallel storyline in your film, the United States role. It's another layer of a film, the U.S. and Saudi relationship. And, there's this idea going back decades that the Saudis have been valuable to the United States. Initially, what did the U.S. get out of this relationship?
Well, I mean, that answer is oil. It was very simple. In the very beginning, it was a commercial relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia was sitting upon the largest resource of global energy. And to this day, Saudi produces 11 million barrels of light sweet crude a day. There's no other country in the world that has the kind of speed and flexibility with which it can inject or withdraw, energy from the global markets. So for a long time, that was the entire deal. So the U.S. was propping up and supporting and arming a regime that, an autocratic absolute monarchy, that didn't look anything like the kind of ideals that we say that we're defending in the world, but was incredibly important to us economically. That relationship evolved significantly after 1979, when the Soviets invade Afghanistan and the war against the Soviets begins there. Saudi Arabia, for the first time then, takes on this role, covertly funding this operation of Arab Islamist fighters who we help, along with Pakistan, send to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan and try to create a Vietnam for the Soviet Union there. This is the beginning of a different kind of relationship with the U.S. and Saudi, where Saudi Arabia becomes a security ally who we use and cooperate with in a bunch of different areas geopolitically. All those equations, so those were the two things that basically carried the relationship for a very long time. But But things have been evolving very rapidly in the last decade. Mm-hmm. Now, with the change in the global oil market, with fracking and with this boom of production in other places, Saudi Arabia is no longer as central to global energy markets as it once was. And the America's geostrategic kind of posture in the region also has changed. And so there are many people who are clamoring for a kind of reevaluation of the U.S.-Saudi relations, that the underlying strategic interests that made this relationship seem inevitable, and many people say it's the most important relationship that the U.S. has in the Middle East, have brought into question, particularly after the role that Saudi Arabia played in crushing the Arab Spring, and now the disastrous war that they have drawn us into in Yemen as well.
So what do we need to understand about the U.S.-Saudi relationship to understand the story of Jamal Khashoggi's life and his work?
Yeah, well, they're woven together, Jamal's arc is woven together with this relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. And I think he was, he was at the forefront of that transformation too. I said earlier, his story is like a redemption story, and he goes through these phases in his life. Well, first, where he's this massive proponent of U.S.-Saudi cooperation in Afghanistan and bin Laden at a time when all those interests coincided. Then when he's an apologist for the Saudi regime trying to defend and maintain the U.S.-Saudi relationship after September 11th, when it seemed in threat. But they managed to do that by lying during the Iraq War. And then after the Arab Spring, becoming estranged, and eventually under Mohammed bin Salman being forced to sort of split. I think the elements inside the American diplomatic establishment have made similar journeys. Mm-hmm. It was the Arab Spring that created immense kind of stress and tension between the Obama administration and Saudi Arabia. Trump and MBS kind of rose together as a backlash against that in every possible way. And I think now we are, we're seeing in the region the results of that, not just the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi, but this horrific war in Yemen that we're involved with, and the crackdown on dissidents inside the country. And there is, this is an election day. We'll see what happens. We'll see what happens here. But it's a moment when there is the possibility, and certainly I think the need, for us to reexamine exactly the contours of our alliance.
You bring up Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and the marketing of MBS. He was marketed kind of around the world as a reformer because he reduced the power of religious police, granted women more autonomy, but he's also been violently consolidating his power. What was it that Jamal saw, and what did he write in the Washington Post that was particularly effective and that would lead to people in power in Saudi Arabia wanting him dead?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Saudi Arabia, the United States is Saudi Arabia's most important ally. We have been their security guarantor for decades. They've depended on us to defend them against threats time and again. And they recognize that and recognize how incredibly important American public opinion is, particularly the opinion of people who make the decisions of people in Washington, D.C. So when Mohammed bin Salman was consolidating power, really by, radically transforming the way that power was exercised inside Saudi Arabia, he went on a publicity blitz in the U.S. He did this tour where he met with business leaders and Mike Bloomberg and everybody in Washington. He went out to Hollywood and met with the heads of studios. He went to Silicon Valley, met with everyone from Google to Apple to all of the centers of American power, rolled out the red carpet to meet with him because of the immense wealth that the Saudi government spends and invests in this country. So parallel to that, they ran a massive PR campaign, and really the only dissenting voice at the time was Jamal Khashoggi, who was in exile here. And he wasn't just writing in some obscure blog on the corners of the internet to an Arabic audience. he was publishing in the opinion pages of the Washington Post, one of the most important papers in the world, but also the hometown paper of the capital of the United States, the most important ally to Saudi Arabia. So it was that could not be tolerated by Mohammed Salman. It was disrupting his entire PR campaign, and was too close to the center of power. Also, Jamal was not. Jamal knew things. Jamal mm-hmm. was close to the center of power in Saudi Arabia for a very long time. He was worked as the aide to the former head of Saudi intelligence. He was friends with bin Laden. He one of the sort of interesting things that we discovered over the course of making this film was that, shortly before he was killed, he met with the lawyers for the families of the victims of September 11th, who have been trying to sue the Saudi government basically since 2001, and have faced various legal blocks, and political campaigns that have tried to quash the case, but it continues to go forward. Jamal met with him and agreed to meet with him another time shortly before he disappeared, and that also was a deeply threatening thing to the kingdom.
One last question for you. As we watch the film, we see the response to his murder. You interview friends who truly mourn him. You have footage of world leaders weighing in. You have one U.S. policy type who basically says the Saudi relationship is more valuable than one person, that it's almost like too big to fail. We see the Saudis' attempted cover-up. What do you think is Jamal Khashoggi's legacy? What did he leave behind? What information did he leave for us?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think he was murdered by the regime that he criticized. They tried to silence him and erase him. But he left behind, the body of his own reporting and also people who were inspired by him. I mean, he's more famous now than he ever was in his mm-hmm. lifetime. And, one of his friends, near the end of the film, speaks to this and says, thinking about what justice would be like for Jamal, and how difficult it is to imagine, a kind of legal proceeding that would bring Mohammed bin Salman before a court, but that there is another way of understanding justice. And that is that you deny to the people who would through death impose silence on him, deny them that silence and keep his story alive. I mean, I find his story to be actually immensely hopeful in spite of how tragic it is, because this is a man who was at the center of power his whole life and still was able to recognize when he had become implicated in horrible crimes and was able to change and transform all the way up until the end. He's almost 60 years old, and he leaves his home, his job, his family, everything he knows because he feels the moral imperative to come and take a stand. So, I mean, I see that as his as an enduring, hopeful message of his life, that it is still possible, no matter how embedded in the system we've become, no matter how much we feel ourselves mm-hmm. to be locked in these tortured compromises, it still is possible to take a moral stand and be free.
The name of the film is Kingdom of Silence. It's streaming on Showtime and Showtime's YouTube channel. I've been speaking with this director, Rick Rowley. Rick, thank you for being with us.